I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For so many of us, much of our lives are spent in front of a screen. No judgment implied there, but just think about it. Many of us have work that keeps us tied to laptops or desktop computers. We check email, personal and professional, all the time, unless we set boundaries for ourselves. TV shows, live sports, funny cat videos, all are at our fingertips at a moment's notice. We somehow expect it to be different, though, for our children. But increasingly, it's not. They have homework assignments online. They do research online. Gone are the days when you could tell your kids, as I was told, to go downstairs and look in the encyclopedia. They talk to their friends on their phones or computers. The question now is not whether or not that's okay. That ship has pretty much sailed. But how can we set appropriate boundaries for our children and for ourselves? How do schools figure out what kind of technology and applications of that technology are appropriate and when? What do we want to teach our young people about how to use and benefit from technological advances and the gazillion applications they have at their fingertips? Today on the show, we're going to explore those ideas. And joining us for the conversation is someone who thinks about this from a lot of different angles. Jason Mattel is chair of the Film and Media Culture Department at Middlebury College. He's also the parent of three kids who are in their teen or preteen years. So he gets to think about his own media consumption, his students' media habits, and his own progeny's technology usage. Jason Mattel, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. Glad to be here.
So do you think about all three of these things all the time? I imagine if I was doing all of that, I'd have no time for work.
Yeah, thankfully, some of that thinking about it is my work. So I can always call it research.
So do you have sort of an overarching philosophy? I mean, as somebody who is chair of the Film and Media Culture Department, I don't expect you to say all technology, all social media, all media is bad. But I also don't anticipate that you're going to say it's all great all the time.
No, it's definitely it's very hard to come out with really clear statements of black and white. One of my favorite books about this topic is called It's Complicated, and that really sums up the issue and all the interrelated issues. There's no one answer, and much like with a lot of parenting, once you've figured out what the answer is, it changes. Your kids get older, and in the case of technology, the entire environment transforms at a moment's notice.
Can you talk a little bit about what you see as the environment for teenagers in particular and maybe even college-age students when it comes to technology? Because there is this push to put your phone down, don't use your phone in class, and yet also, by the way, you can get your homework assignment online and hand it in online, and we expect you to be reading, but not Wikipedia. You know, there's this sort of mixed message that kids are getting.
Definitely. And I think that kids are getting messages from a whole bunch of different fronts. They're hearing from their parents, hopefully, something about technology. Unfortunately, there are some families in which it's just not a topic of conversation. And so I think that's an important conversation to have. And again, it's a complicated conversation, but important.
We might also point out that there are places where, you know, your family doesn't have a laptop or your family doesn't have smartphones. And so it's less of a just not talking about it and more of an area where some people are being left behind. But
oh, definitely. And I mean, certainly in Vermont, we have some problems in terms of digital access, in terms of broadband and the like. So even if you have a phone or a laptop, you can't necessarily connect to the internet from your home.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely it plays out along class lines, along geography here. So that's one of the factors in which everything can be very different depending on who you are and who your family is. And then schools, I think there's been a push to incorporate technology into classrooms, into computer labs at schools, into the libraries, and to have more homework and coursework being done via technology. And yet, oftentimes, the instruction is coming from teachers who have never been trained on how to use the technology thoughtfully. And then kids obviously hear a lot from their peers. And within any given school, there's certainly a wide range of practices. There are kids who have smartphones starting at age 8. There are kids who graduate high school without a phone. So it's really a very uneven terrain, and it's hard to make many generalizations. And I also think that another key issue in Vermont is that so many of the places in which we live are very rural and very isolating. And sometimes technology can really help bridge that gap. And in other cases, technology may not be as needed. Like you need some sort of forms of mobile technology in a city in a very different way than you do on a farm.
Like what? What are you thinking there?
Well, I know that a lot of kids who grew up in the city are commuting on their own on public transportation. And there's a sense of in order to have their mobility feel, you know, parents feel confident in their ability to navigate the city, the fact that they are always in touch is a great asset. Now, a previous generation, I grew up and, you know, spent a lot of time on my own in Boston. And I always had a quarter in my wallet so that I knew I could always call a payphone. And of course, we don't have payphones.
Yeah, how quaint, Jason.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, this idea that I could be in an urban space and not be connected or not be available at the drop of a hat feels very quaint, I think, to parents today. Mm-hmm. Even a lot of parents don't let their kids free range very often. But when they do, they feel a lot more comfortable if they have a phone. So there's a sense of there is a two-way line of communication out there. But depending on where you are in, you know, in the Middlebury area where I live, there are a lot of areas where you can have a phone, but it won't work because there's a big mountain.
Well, Middlebury is an interesting example, too, because what was it, 8 or 9 years ago now, there was a train derailment in town and it separated yeah. much of the town from the elementary and high school. And so there were a lot of parents, I think, who at that time in that specific community were thinking about this question of how would I reach my child? How would I tell my child how to get to me in a situation like the one that just happened where, you know, maybe middle schoolers didn't yet have smartphones, but should they now so their parents could get in touch with them? And we see it again in communities around the country when it comes to questions of use of technology in lockdown situations and stuff like that.
That's right. You hear about, you know, these tragic school shootings and the ways in which at moments like that, the kids who have a cell phone have an ability to connect in a way that's you know hugely important in a much less high stress environment like the train derailment. Yes, I had three kids during that. They were all at three different schools, and my wife and I were trying to scramble just to figure out how do we all keep in touch, and we didn't have working phones at that moment. So yes, it was very much a sense that the need to be able to be in touch has real upsides, and I think that most kids and families see that as the default norm, if possible, in your community. If you don't have, if you're not so rural or so much in the mountains that it's unavailable. So I think the way in which connection and this idea that you are always connection is a real transformation. It's not the world that we grew up in. One of the main things I always like to think about in terms of media is to ask how do media form an environment? And really thinking about that idea of connectivity, the idea that you are living in an environment in which the assumed norm is you are always available. You are always potentially in contact with someone. And that if you text someone, the sense is they must have seen it. And then the fact that they're not responding feels like they're waiting or ignoring you rather than the sense of they'll get to it when they get to it.
Professor Mattel, you must think about this when you talk about how some families are not really discussing technology. It almost sounds like the ways we talk about families and schools should be teaching financial literacy. They should be teaching, you know, sex ed to their kids. Is technology and technological boundaries and how to behave and how to not bully online, is that all wrapped up into what we should all now be teaching our children as well?
Definitely. I think that a core component of a formal education in primary and secondary school has to be digital citizenship. And that's the way I like to frame it. So it's not about protecting your kids from technology or teaching kids how to defend themselves, but rather how can you be a productive and ethical citizen in an online world? And that ranges from understanding the norms of privacy and security that are in play to thinking about the ethics in play about peer-to-peer communication, understanding what something means to be visible in public versus private, shareable versus tied to a particular user, And understanding all those elements, it's really, I think, part of what we used to call civics and really should be integrated into the curriculum.
Is that something that you have to talk to college students about?
Yeah, I definitely. We find at Middlebury we have a very diverse population from a lot of different places, including international, and from different socioeconomic groups. And they've all had very different experiences as to the way in which technology has played out in their schools. There are some who have taken online classes and are very much feel like this is an area where they know how to learn. And others have never had those experiences. And I don't think we or any college or university does a great job of trying to level that playing field. It's really hard. But I think that at the – what has to happen is it has to be integrated into earlier curricula. And one of the challenges is the way in which our federal and state education curricula are being structured is things like media literacy are seen as frivolous rather than essential.
You think that's actually sort of a feeling out there that this is frivolous?
Certainly. I think that if you look at a lot of education reforms that have happened over the past 20 years, it's been about emphasizing a lot of core curriculum. And yes, there's a recognition that being able to use digital tools is important, but it's not actually given its own subject area. I would love to see one of the core competencies or core curricular areas that's taught in Vermont schools to be media literacy, digital citizenship.
Let's go to Cynthia, who's calling in from Putnam Station, New York. Hi, Cynthia. Go right ahead.
Hi. My comment is my daughter got a smartphone when she was about 14, maybe even a little younger. It's hard to remember now. But it was not my doing. It was through a relative who wanted to give it to her, and they put her on their plan. And, you know, it was a brand new iPhone. Yeah, so anyway, I let her have it and noticed that this A student who was a tremendous reader all of a sudden just walked away from books and from reading. And that's how it's been for the past 5 years.
And you connect those two, Cynthia?
I'm sorry?
You connect those two things? You think that one caused the other, that the acquisition of a smartphone is what led to her stopping reading?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, if I'd known, I would have probably put up more of made it more of an issue. I do see the need. I live in a really rural area, and internet service is pretty spotty. At the time it was, she took an online course, and we had real difficulty finding internet service. We would go to the library and sit outside late at night just to access their service after it was closed. But just to get back to the point of giving kids at an early age a phone, I'm not against that because of, again, in a rural area, people are busy. You need to stay in touch. Who's picking up who? You know, when you live 15 miles from the school, you need to be in touch. And I would just recommend a flip phone, just a phone that you can call on, not something that does all the bells and whistles.
Well, Cynthia, let me put that to Jason Mattel. What do you think? You know, Cynthia says, my daughter got a phone and she stopped reading. And, you know, I'm not questioning her judgment on that, but, you know, what do you think about that causality and how to then approach something like that with a kid who may be finding online games or online communication more interesting than the books she liked before?
Yeah, it's a challenge. And I think that there's I'm always, as a researcher, very reluctant to sort of generalize from anecdotes or to suggest causality where there's just correlation.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's no doubt that time is a finite thing. And if you are anyone, a kid or an adult, I mean, think back to, you know, listeners out there, if you have a smartphone, when you first got it, it often gets your attention. And smartphones and apps are designed by very skilled professionals to make us want to use them more. You know, that is part of their business model. So there's no doubt that they do suck up our attention, and that is a finite resource. So I'm sure that that does happen. I do think that there are ways to navigate the needs that you really want to have a phone or an internet-enabled device for versus the infinite temptations that a smartphone has. So I think a flip phone idea is a great idea, especially for younger kids. If the primary goal is just to be able to know where someone is and call in cases of either emergency or just logistics, flip phones or other dumb phones are a great option. If you do want to have the internet available via a phone for being able to do schoolwork or even just other forms of communication, there are a number of apps that try to restrict access to what can be used, what can't be used. You can put it on a family plan where you can kind of monitor what material is being used on the phone. But then also trying to figure out some limits within the family itself to say, here are phone times, here are non-phone times. Here are the way that we can balance our media diet. And I think that that's really important to do as a parent. It's also really important to model that behavior. I am certainly no paragon in this area, and oftentimes feel myself being sucked in. Oh, one more email to look at, or one more round of this game, or whatever it might be. The desire to keep being immersed because it's pleasurable. But then think about that balance of what aren't you doing? Set aside times in a family where these are no phone times. Dinner time in our household, there are never phones at the dinner table. That's
for anybody,
just a rule.
Adults
for anybody.
Or kids.
Yep. Yeah, and we try, unless we're expecting some emergency call, if a phone rings, we don't get up. It can probably wait for 20 minutes.
What? And 20 minutes? Jeepers.
I know. But, you know, I think about these types of limits. Growing up as a kid, you know, sometimes we had a TV near where we're eating dinner, and I think about that, and that was not the greatest environment for me, at least, of trying to have a family conversation. So long before smartphones, we said that's not going to happen as parents. And I think that you can set those boundaries, and I think that's really important to do. And what it demonstrates to kids is I care about how you're spending your time, and I'm willing to follow some rules that I want you to follow as well.
We're talking with Middlebury College Film and Media Culture Department Chair Jason Mattel, who deals with this in his own work, in teaching college students, and in raising his own teenage children. John is calling in from Burlington. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think one of the things that we're dealing with, I'm a parent of a middle school child. One of the things that we're dealing with is that we haven't established societal norms for cell phone usage and internet usage. So, you know, if a 12-year-old sneaks a beer out of the fridge, everybody knows that that's too young because there's a norm in society. Whereas if an 18-year-old sneaks a beer out of the fridge, it's kind of allowed. I see parents that are very strict when it comes to drugs and alcohol and sex give their children phones at the age of 10, 11, and 12. And I think that we're going to find over the next 20 years that that we can really start to develop some societal norms that we haven't had enough time to develop yet.
John, do you see that starting to happen? I mean, do you see that sort of figuring out where the lines are and what appropriate ages are?
I do. And I see people, children, including my own, that had a phone when they were in fifth grade that are no longer allowed to have phones in eighth grade. And it creates some real challenges. It's how kids communicate. They don't call each other. They only text each other. I mean, so they have this argument that if you don't give me a phone, I can't have friends.
Hmm.
But
you're not
but
sold
more
by that?
And more people. Excuse me?
You're not sold on that argument?
I'm not sold on that argument. but I'm balancing it out. We have to balance it out. A lot of people are sold on that argument. I have the conversation on a daily basis with parents, other parents of children in my child's age.
Huh. John, I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts on that and this idea that we are perhaps in the early days and still haven't figured out where we fall as a culture sort of cohesively and then individually as a parent, how you're making changes even as your children grow and develop. It's really interesting. And on that note, let's get another voice in here. Megan Cope is on the line with us. She's a geographer at the University of Vermont, and she studies how physical built landscapes interact with social landscapes. After hearing about today's show, she reached out and pointed us to a study that she co-authored a couple of years back called Mobility, Communication, and Place, Navigating the Landscapes of Suburban U.S. Teens. This research looked at schools in Vermont to get insight into how technology, like what we're talking about today with phones and social media, actually affect how and where teens get to where they want to go and how they interact with each other, just as John was just talking about. Professor Cope, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So this is all part of a project called Mapping American Childhood. How did this look at phones and how kids get to where they want to get to fit into that?
Right. So Brian Lee, the co-author, and I were interested in the ways that our land use patterns actually affect the way that teens can get around, particularly before they have a license and a car. Then we realized pretty quickly that a lot of their transportation depends on communication. And, of course, with increasing phone use, that communication is happening through texting, calling, and so forth. So we were really interested in this connection between the land use patterns as well as transportation and then the communication element. So that's really where we entered into looking at how teens use these technologies to kind of coordinate their daily lives and organize where they need to go and also how they perceive places that they're unable to get to, either because of transportation or because of a lack of communication that would allow them to get there.
Like what? Give me an example of that.
Right. So there were places that – so we did our work – I should just say that we did our work based in both South Burlington High School and CVU. And what we found was that the South Burlington residents, the teens, were able to get more places in part because it's a denser land use and there is better bus service and more walkable neighborhoods. And the CVU students, being representative of those multiple towns, many of which are much, much lower density and more spread out, and some of which did, at least the time we were doing our study, did not have good cell phone coverage, those kind of both built and digital environment sort of qualities were restricting teens' abilities to, say, get to a part-time job or get to a particular friend's house. And, you know, even without the communication side of it, the lower density and spread out nature of the school district was a barrier. But then when you add in the communication piece, kids in Charlotte, for instance, who didn't have a cell phone signal had a harder time communicating kind of on the spur of the moment with their friends to do that last minute planning that we all know teens are really good at.
Jason Mattel, how does this intersect with what you experience as a parent when you're trying to navigate these questions of technology? And as John said, you know, teenagers and kids now who say, A, I can't have friends if I don't have technology, and I can't get to where I want to go if I don't have the technology. You know, how does that intersect with your work, but also with your parenting?
Yeah, I definitely feel it more as a parent in that I think one of the primary jobs of any parent of teenagers is managing where they are at any given time and how to get them there. And there's no doubt that having phones makes that much easier and also potentially is an opportunity to get kids to take some more responsibility for communicating and for making arrangements. And so that's, for me, a big upside of having mobile devices and phones. And then they can start to really think about, well, my job as, you know, as a member of a family is to be available and to communicate as to what's going on at a given time.
Does that resonate with you, Megan Cope? I mean, these ideas of not only how teenagers are using it, but then how it's sort of working their way into family dynamics and ideas of growing up and that partly having this technology can aid you in becoming a more mature, more adult person.
Absolutely. So our study included a survey of parents as well as teens, and we asked them a lot of questions about
things like family rules, like curfews and places, you know, or people that you shouldn't be with. And then also, how do you communicate? And so what we found was, and this reinforces a lot of other work that has been done in this area, we found that parents whose teenagers had, or even younger kids, we obviously our youngest were 14, they were freshmen in high school, parents whose kids had phones and were in touch regularly felt more comfortable allowing their kids to, you know, roam more freely, you know, to travel on their own, you know, either by bike or later on perhaps by car. And on the kids' side, they too felt that they had more freedom when they had the phone because they were able to be in touch quite quickly.
You know, I know that you are a researcher, and like Tyson Mattel said, you want to rely on data and research and peer-reviewed studies. But I'm curious how this feels to you. I don't know how old you are, Megan, but I imagine that this is not what your childhood felt like if you're, you know, at least in your upper 30s by
right.
now.
Well, thank you. I would love to be still in my upper 30s. But no, and in fact, my experience growing up in the 1970s is very different. I currently have two teenage daughters who are 15 and 17. And we are navigating this literally every day in our own family. And so it is incredibly different. I feel that my daughters are safer than I was in a way because they can get in touch very quickly. I think about some of the things, places I went and things I did as a kid and, you know, as a teen, growing up that weren't necessarily dangerous, but I just had no way of getting in touch with people. And I think about that now, and it makes me retrospectively worried.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you often hear about the ways that technology can be dangerous, and you can certainly think of things that teenagers are doing that their parents may not be aware of and may not even have access to when we talk about various apps and how scary that can be for adults. But also then the flip side of that is this ability to be in touch with your young people and to have them be able to reach out to you. So it's not that situation, at least when I was in high school and college, where they said, just tell them you need to call your parents and go find a payphone somewhere and you know, just sit tight and we'll get to you in an hour. It really is a different landscape now for young people, Megan Cope.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that comes with both new anxieties and new assurances. So parents and teens are both, you know, we're all kind of in this together, exploring a completely new territory. And there are going to be things that are reassuring, and there are also going to be new sources of anxiety.
That's Megan Cope, a geography professor at UVM. She's been telling us a little bit about her research into teenagers' use of technology, especially to figure out transportation and how to get to and from where they would like to go. Megan, thank you very much for talking with us and for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We are talking about kids and technology and a lot of the ways we navigate this parental landscape, also the school landscape. Gerard is calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Gerard. Go right ahead.
Oh.
Hi.
As a longtime teacher, I have some very specific opinions on what is best for children. It seems like everyone is speaking about the need for the parent and student to keep in contact. Makes perfect sense. That doesn't mean that the student cannot exercise self-control or the parent cannot see that they have certain limitations without even doing the machine. If the grades go down, take the phone away for a while. If they let the phone ring in the classroom, have them not have it in the classroom. With the shortened attention span of students nowadays, a ringing of a phone can break the thought pattern of every student in the classroom. There seems to be just a language lesson that needs to be learned. And I worked in reform schools, I worked in public, I worked in private schools extensively, and it's very, very simple. You learn that language, teach your kid the word no. and be consistent and follow it and do and, you know, don't make exceptions. I mean, you know, you set the firm line and it does work.
Yeah, Gerard, I appreciate that perspective. And Jason Mattel, you were talking earlier about civics and sort of social etiquette, and this has to be a part of it, right? I mean, in addition to having everything at your fingertips, is not only at home at dinner time, but in a classroom setting, what is and isn't appropriate and where your schools should be able to set boundaries about what students are allowed to have in terms of technology in the classroom.
Yeah, and it's the problem is it's really tricky because any device that's connected to the internet isn't just able to deliver the good stuff that you want to have in the classroom, you know, Google Docs for students to work on a project together or being able to do research online or play educational games at a younger age, whatever it might be. These are all things that are in the classrooms right now and that in many ways are great. But it's an internet-connected device, so therefore it's not just the green vegetables. It's the entire grocery store is available. So they can, you know, use those devices, whether in class or while they're doing their homework, to go anywhere. So it's very difficult to just set clear boundaries about the use of technology because you also have to think about the use of and the access to different realms of content. And and it's tricky. And so that is a conversation that you have to have. And I think it's a conversation that teachers have to have as well. If you're going to allow devices or in some cases even require devices in the classroom, you have to figure out, well, what's appropriate and what's not. How do you communicate that? How do you enforce that? And it's a challenge. It's a challenge at primary, secondary, and in higher ed.
Let's go to Sarah in Middlebury. Hi, Sarah. You're on the line now.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Thanks. Hi. I was just calling just to ask Jason what he thought about sort of the role of schools in the, you know, the erosion of interpersonal skills that kids seem to have nowadays where, you know, because they're texting so much, they don't really know how to have conversations with each other. And how, you know, schools could support, you know, developing that or limiting cell phone use to promote better interpersonal skills, as well as, you know, it seems like there's a rising level of anxiety as well in kids these days that seems to line up with, you know, increased social media use.
Sarah, thanks for the call and question. Jason Mattel, what do you think?
I think, again, it's really tricky. There's a lot of research that suggests potential correlations between social media use and changes in mental health. But there's a lot of other research that debunks those correlations and suggests that that's really not what's going on. So we don't have any answers there. In terms of communication skills, the question I always try to ask is, why is a kid choosing to do this particular digital practice? So whether it's playing a video game or texting or creating a sort of online artwork and sharing it, any of these things, they're doing it in order to fulfill some sort of need. I think that when we think about communication with their peers, texting has some really distinct advantages for the way in which you navigate time and space. And we all do it as adults. And so I'm not comfortable saying that it's eroding other forms of communication. I think that it is serving different functions. For me, as both an educator and a parent, I want to just have that transparent conversation. What does texting someone mean versus calling them versus talking to them face-to-face versus sending them an email? These are all different modes of communications. And getting students and your kids to think critically about that, to understand the way in which each one of these has different dimensions, different functions, and different implications, I think that's the way to do it, not to ban one or to say you have to use another.
That's Jason Mattel, chair of the Film and Media Culture Department at Middlebury College. Jason, thank you so much for helping us navigate this conversation today. I really appreciate your insight.
Thanks for having me, Jane.